senior editor of Notice, Dave Leventhal. Dave, welcome back to Hardline.
A pleasure and an honor to be back with you, Joe.
All right, I'm going to bookend this thing with non-political things, and we're going to start with those new Bills jerseys, the Nickel City jerseys. I think they look awful. What's your thought?
Hey, look, aesthetics, we can talk about them, but really the only thing that matters at the end of the day and the end of the game is whether we've won or lost. So if they win in those jerseys, great. That is way better than losing in red, white, and blue, as far as I'm concerned. So
that's a great point.
They're not the greatest in the world. Not in love with them. Not going to be rushing out to BuffaloBills.com to plunk down $200 for a custom stitched jersey or anything. That's just me. You do you. Victory is really all I'm pretty much caring about here, if that's okay.
That's a great point. No, you're right. You're right. I, regardless, will not go out and buy anything with this jersey. I'll go buy, the standard Bill stuff that you and I love. But if they win in these jerseys, I'm going to be just as loud as if it was red, white, and blue.
Yeah, they're going to look a whole lot better if we're putting up W's against New England and the rest of the division and various other teams. I don't know, like Detroit.
Yeah,
that would be really great. I would love that.
That would be great. Cannot wait to get to the new stadium, Dave. I was not there yesterday. Gave my tickets to a friend, but I'm looking forward to getting in and seeing if it has the new stadium smell.
Did the same. Had a whole bunch of friends actually who were there yesterday, including on my tickets. And absolutely wild to see the photos and the videos that they shot and all the reactions to the folks who were there. It seems just absolutely awesome, and I can't wait to be there for the home opener.
Yes, it's going to be great. Dave, we should talk about this off the air, but the home opener, the day after, I'm driving to Maryland. I'm going toward your direction after the day after the home opener for a Virginia Tech game.
Well, you should divert, and we should have dinner or something and celebrate a Bills victory, as far as I'm concerned.
That sounds great to me. But first, Dave, we do have to get to the serious stuff, and it seems like this has come up every time we've talked for the last few months, and that is Iran. We were told this wouldn't lag on, and Dave, even people in the president's camp are getting frustrated with Iran.
Yeah, and we're going, for those keeping track at home here, we're going on 6 months here later this month that this war has been going on. And I think we have to, in moments like this, step back, go back to what the original goals and projections were for this conflict, for this war, and understand where we are at today. And on the question of nuclear material, has the United States fully secured that in Iran? No, that objective is not objectively been taken care of. The ballistic missiles and the military capabilities of Iran, are they decimated? Are they gone? No, they're not. And that's clear from the missiles and the bombs that continue to fall on U.S. allies all throughout the Middle Eastern region, including the UAE and Kuwait and Jordan, even Egypt getting involved, and so forth. The fundamental change in leadership, the popular uprising in Iran that Donald Trump had asked for and hoped for, that never materialized. And still the basic government structure that was in place before the war remains in place today, despite there being a number of leaders that have been killed. And then we have the issues of things that have happened since the war began, which have, in essence, set things back even further than they were on February 28th when this all began, first one being the Strait of Hormuz and what the status is there. We have Iran now talking about tolling ships and having a tax there. So the idea of international free waters is, in essence, just been again thrown into complete question. And that's going to have a direct effect on the economy, both here domestically and across the world. And then there's the issue of the widening conflict and, Houthi rebels and Yemen getting involved and what might be happening with other countries wanting to unilaterally strike back at Iran. Saudi Arabia is a big wild card here. Israel is a huge wild card, too, in the sense that the United States and Israel are not always seeing eye to eye on everything. And just overnight, Israel basically rejecting the United States peace plan for Gaza, the latest one that had come up. So that is a somewhat unrelated, but definitely a tethered situation that obviously has huge political implications, not only here at home, but also for Israel, too, with Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, up for re-election in October, and hardly a guarantee that he is going to win. So a lot going on here. Sorry to go a little long there, but it's a complicated situation that has not gotten any more clarity, only the opposite over the past couple of weeks.
So when you talk to Republicans, obviously in a midterm election where, you know, I mean, the cards are stacked against usually the incumbent party, what do most Republicans on Capitol Hill want the president to do when it comes to the Iran conflict?
I mean, they want to win, number one, but number two, they really don't want to talk about it any more than they have to, because this is not a winning issue for Republicans. You look at polls right now, and really it's across the board. Easy to dismiss polls, but this is public sentiment in the moment, a snapshot in time. And whether you are a Democrat or an independent, you're almost certainly against what's going on right now. And Republican support for the war has also been bleeding kind of drop by drop over the past many weeks, too, to the point where there are many, many other issues that Republicans would like to hear Republicans talk about and think are winning issues. This is not among them. So this is sort of the thing where a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill would like to sweep it under the proverbial rug a little bit, but that's going to be pretty darn difficult to do, particularly when this is costing tens and tens of billions of dollars that could be spent elsewhere, or for that matter, saved and turned into, I don't know, tax decreases or lots of other things to fund various priorities across the country. So the money is real, the dollars and the cents, the math is math. And this is something that is going to have to be defended on the campaign trail, even though Republicans don't want to, because they're going to be in the heat in the teeth of a general election. And you better believe the Democrats are going to bring it up at every turn.
The Democratic Socialist, Dave, we had a few primaries in downstate New York a few weeks ago where Democrat Socialist had a great night. Here in Western New York, we had one Democratic Socialist candidate defeat the endorsed Democrat. And then obviously in Michigan, we had El Sayed win his primary. But, you know, I talked to Aaron Geis. He's running against Nick Laneworthy in NY23, a pretty red district. And the first thing he said was, well, I'm not a Democratic Socialist. So it seems like you have, you know, these spots where the Democratic Socialists are doing well, and a lot of people in the Democrat Party saying, whoa, we're not completely aligned.
Yeah, that's a mouthful, and it's very true, too. So a couple of things can kind of be true at the same time. Number one, there is a schism in the Democratic Party. There's no question about that. And sort of these traditionalist, more quote-unquote mainstream Democrats, they are not happy with this, not happy at all. And you have entities, including different super PACs and politically motivated nonprofit organizations that have millions and millions of dollars behind them, who have been actively working against the Democratic Socialists because they believe fundamentally that they are not going to be winning candidates in the context of a general election. And that brings us to another point, which is that Democratic Socialists running against a kind of, you know, regular old Republican candidate, that's not going to necessarily bode well for Democrats in a general election scenario. But this is so true for Democrats and Republicans alike, where if you nominate in your primary process a candidate who plays to the more extreme ends of your party, well, something usually has to happen for them to win in a general election context. When everyone is going to be voting, including people who don't vote in primaries, those independents who in many states make up the majority, or at least the plurality of the people who are going to be voting. You have so many states, Joe, across the country where maybe 30% of people are registered Democrats and 31% of people are registered Republicans. And the rest, you know, roughly 40%, are going to be independents and not attached to any party one way or another. So those kind of silent independents, they matter so much in general elections. And if you have an extreme left wing type of candidate who really isn't attracting the more moderate centrist types or people who might swing a little bit right or a little bit left, but aren't too crazy about extremes on other sides, well, all right, you know, what's in it for them? And a democratic socialist agenda may not necessarily be it.
Is this the Democrats' Tea Party?
That's a great question. There are so many differences between what caused the Tea Party to happen back in sort of the ashes of the 2008 economic meltdown. The Democratic Socialists have been around for a while. This is something that has sort of been less of a just immediate pop-up phenomenon and has been more kind of like a slow move in this direction and gaining steam and speed here in 2026. Let's remember the Squad back a few election cycles ago now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others who, for all intents and purposes, even if they're not waving the banner all the time, they're democratic socialists and they believe in elements of socialism. But kind of lost in all of this too is just even the basic definitions of what is a socialist? What is a democratic socialist? What is a communist? What's a Marxist? And as somebody who went to school in part to get a political philosophy degree, I got to laugh sometimes at the way that people are defining all of these things and mixing and matching for their own purposes. And this is people on the right and the left, what these things are and what they mean in a current contemporary context. So, yeah, you know, I mean, you have the government right now literally buying stakes in private companies. And, you know, by definition of socialism, that would be it, too. And that's the Trump administration. So I only bring this up to say, you know, before you define and put easy labels on anyone, right or left, it's good to kind of know exactly what it is that we're talking about here. But that all being said, it is going to absolutely, you know, be something that is compared to the Tea Party because of what's happening here. It's also, too, not necessarily a fair comparison because the democratic socialist phenomenon here in 2026 is still pretty limited. You have a number of high-profile races, but that number is not massive. It's not dozens and dozens. It's more kind of single digits, low double digits, and most of the Democratic candidates that are getting nominated are still kind of your standard issue Democrats who in many cases are incumbents and have been around forever and in some cases forever and are in their 70s and 80s, which opens up a whole nother can of worms about the age of Congress and the Senate when you have, you know, issues like Mitch McConnell and James Clyburn running for, you know, in his late 80s and various other things such as that. So expect that to be part of the discussion as well amid all of these other things that we just mentioned.
Dave, Anthony Fauci was held in contempt. It was right down the party vote. Now that gets sent to Trump's DOJ. But I mean, is there really anything going to happen after that? Or is this kind of just like a symbolic thing?
Well, it's been great theater, of course. And if you hate Anthony Fauci, then you've been cheering this all along. And if you love the guy, it's an opportunity for you to go on Facebook and tell everyone exactly what a hero you think he is. I mean, let's just talk about the politics and the legal aspects of it in a moment here. First of all, this was a committee vote to hold Fauci in contempt of Congress. It wasn't a vote of the full Senate, which could be very problematic for the next step, which is the Department of Justice deciding whether it even wants to go forward with this, which is a huge, massive if at this point. You have the idea of a grand jury not even willing to go forward and declining to move forward in a grand jury proceeding with this. You also have the issue of whether Fauci, at least in this latest iteration of the debate and war, a little war between him and Rand Paul, whether he actually did anything wrong and whether using his Fifth Amendment rights was in order. You have the question of whether Paul kind of actually skirted the law by not going through the regular process of sending this to the full Senate. So it's pretty messy. And even though it got lots and lots of headlines and lots of attentions, I agree that there is a scenario and a very plausible one at that where this all just kind of peters out and nothing becomes of it. There was a whole lot of smoke and zero fire. But the Department of Justice could surprise, and if it really wants to make an issue out of it, it has that ability to do so. But it's still going to be something that even if they got aggressive would be likely months and months and months of wrangling and legal back and forth before anything became of it at all.
You ever wonder what these committee hearings were like before cameras? Like, everyone just, like, gives their speeches. It's all for the clip they can put on social media. I wonder, in, like, the 40s, did these things wrap up in 40 minutes?
Well, I don't have to wonder because, you know, been doing this long enough where it wasn't instant to YouTube and it wasn't instant to TikTok and it wasn't instant where the people who are on those committees who are also running for things typically were putting them up and blasting them out, and the parties and the super PACs and all the rest of them were doing the same too to score easy political points. I mean, the fact of the matter is that politics, when you're talking about coalition building, when you're talking about trying to build the fabric and the tensile strength of your party, that is slow. That is boring. It's very easy to put a video up there. It's very easy to rage bait. It's very easy to put something on social media to get a whole bunch of clicks. But the other stuff is not that easy. And, you know, when committees or Congress in general really, truly want to work on something that is going to involve compromise and involve benefit to the general public in as great a sense as possible, that stuff oftentimes is not video clip friendly. So that's also something to keep in mind. But yeah, it wasn't even 15, 20 years ago where that was much more the case than it is today. But we live in 2026, and this is the way that politics works. And you can choose as a voter to either take that for what it is, or you can ignore it too. It's your right, and it's you still retain that ability. You don't have to just simply be spoon-fed what's being put out for you.
Speaking of that committee, this is on notice. The Senator Gary Peters, who was very vocal in these hearings, he's doing something that we've seen a lot of here in Erie County, right? You had the mayor of Buffalo. He left the job to go to a casino. You had the former DA to go to a law firm, but now he's back in politics. Anyway, Gary Peters, not even out of politics, he's doing what those two men did, negotiating the next move in his career.
Absolutely. This is something I exclusively reported in Notice on Friday, that he is entered contract negotiations, or at least employment negotiations, with the University of Southern California. So long way away from Washington, D.C. and Michigan, but nevertheless, got my hands on an ethics document that had his signature right there on it. His office confirmed to me that, in fact, that is true, that he is doing this. And he's still got 5 months left in the Senate, but very much thinking and kind of California dreaming here a little bit about what his next move might be. Nobody would say, and the university wouldn't talk to me about it either, about what exactly this employment, if it comes to fruition, would entail, whether he would be out there teaching, whether he might be working for the Government Affairs Office of the University of Southern California. And mind you, lots of universities have a presence here in D.C. on a lobbying and government affairs end, or if he might be associated and tied to what is a Capitol campus, as they like to call it, for USC, which is just a massive private college based in Los Angeles. So this is not new, though. Many, many, many outgoing members of the House and the Senate do this, and they start thinking about their next gig well before their term of public service ends. And some of them do definitely go into academia in one form or fashion.
Dave, registration for the Turkey Trot opened up this week, and new trail this week, the one that we know and love, no longer with the closure of the Delaware YMCA. We are starting and ending at the convention center. What are your thoughts?
Oh boy, man. And we see each other there almost every year. And if the running gods are willing here, this will be my 30th consecutive Turkey Trot coming back home for it. One of my favorite things to do every year. And I'll tell you, there are a couple things I won't miss from the old map, which is that hill between Forest and Delavan, which always kicks my butt and makes me question why I do this every year. And but then there's, like, you know, waving at Millard Fillmore and Red Jacket and Rick James as you cross through Gates Circle, where I was born, at Millard Fillmore Gates Circle, of course, not there for many, many years, and then running that long, you know, kind of mostly downhill down Delaware Avenue, which is glorious. So it will be very different. It will be very interesting. I kind of wonder how everyone is going to, 14,000 people, make that first very quick one block turn onto Church Street with the new map. So that could be a little tight. I have a feeling we might all be standing there, for those of us who, you know, run 10 and 11 minute miles for about 20 minutes. So That'll be interesting too. But one thing I do know is that it is just an absolutely amazing event and unlike anything else. And if you haven't done it and have any inkling to do so, you can register now, and I would suggest that you do. It's just an incredible experience.
No better way to start Thanksgiving, Dave, especially this year. I mean, my gosh, you get to run, you get to see everyone at the convention center, and then you have to go home and, you know, deal with the family for a few hours, and then you get to go to Orchard Park. What a day!
and a guaranteed, 1,500 calorie burn before 10 o'clock. You might down a couple of Labatts at the convention center and start putting that back on immediately. But yeah, guilt-free Thanksgiving is never a bad thing.
Absolutely. Well, Dave, thank you so much for joining us as always on this Sunday. We'll be listening for you Tuesday with Susan and Brian, and we will talk soon.
Great pleasure. Go Bills.